Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is actor John Garfield. Born Jacob Julius Garfinkel in 1913, Julie Garfield started acting as part of the group theater in New York. In 1937, he moved to Hollywood, making his screen debut in Michael Curtiz's comedy drama, Four Daughters, starring Claude Rains. Despite not showing up until halfway through the movie, Garfield nevertheless made such an impression that he was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. Despite that amazing beginning, though, his studio, Warner Brothers, didn't really seem to know what to do with him after that, putting him in a series of films that didn't really connect critically or at the box office, including a sequel to Four Daughters called Four Wives. Turned down for military service during World War II, Garfield finally found a persona that clicked with audiences. A tough guy, sympathetic, maybe not always too bright, but someone always trying to fight their way out of the situation that fate has forced them into. He appeared with Spencer Tracy and Hedy Lamarr in Tortilla Flat, Cary Grant in Destination Tokyo, Edward G. Robinson in The Seawolf, and Gregory Peck in Gentleman's Agreement. In 1946, he starred in what was probably his most famous film, The Postman Always Rings Twice, with Lana Turner. He played the doomed Frank Chambers, who engages in an illicit affair with Turner and plots with her to kill her husband. Garfield earned another Oscar nomination for the 1947 boxing film Body and Soul, a film he helped get made with his producing partner, Bob Roberts. He also appeared in film noir classics like Nobody Lives Forever, Force of Evil, and The Breaking Point. Despite being relatively uncommitted politically, his background as a member of the 1930s American Communist Party came back to haunt him when he became a target for the House Un-American Activities Committee. Hounded by the government to name names, something Garfield refused to do, he found himself suddenly unemployable. As film work dried up, he tried to return to the theater and even trying out the new medium of television, neither of which succeeded. Financially strapped and despondent about not being able to find work, Garfield would co-produce one last film with Roberts, He Ran All the Way, before dying of a heart attack in 1952 at the age of 39. His funeral in his hometown of New York became an event attended by thousands of fans. Joining me to talk about He Ran All the Way and the career of John Garfield is graphic designer, film noir expert, podcaster, and my pal, Michael Cronenberg. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on. This means a lot. John Garfield, pretty important actor name in my life, going way back.
Well, thank you so much for being here. We've done a couple shows together. We did a Film and Water talking about The Setup, one of the great all-time boxing movies. And of course, you are an expert when it comes to boxing. And then we did The Hitchhiker. We did Ila Lupino's The Hitchhiker. Right. And then we did Superman versus Muhammad Ali over at Treasury Cast. So John Garfield, I mean, we went through a list of a couple of names of people you might want to talk about. And this name, I mean, I was familiar with John Garfield, kind of jumped out at me because his career was so kind of brief. It was like he burned brightly for a very short period of time. And then as I mentioned in the intro, he passed away at a very young age. So let's get right to it. I want to ask you, like, why does John Garfield, why is he so important to you? Why does he loom so large in sort of your movie memories?
Well, my parents were Depression kids. And my mother was one of those girls, one of those women, young women, who loved John Garfield. He was a matinee idol. I don't think people realize how popular he really was. You mentioned about his funeral, the thousands that attended his funeral. He was so amazingly popular. He was such a box office star. But she was in love with him, and she was at Coney Island, and she was on the beach, and she spotted my father. She looked at him, and she said, "That man looks exactly like John Garfield. I'm going to marry him." And you know wow. what? My father did look like John Garfield. And so she ended up marrying him, of course. But that was the story. And she fell in love with him when she saw Four Daughters, which was his, like you were saying, which is his screen debut. He was the talk of my life growing up with movies, because my mother was a big movie fan. She loved films. I think I got my love of movies in a lot of ways from her, as I got my love of boxing and sports from my father. And just to relate, I rewatched and decided to rewatch for the countless time, body and soul. And it reminded me again that the story of Garfield's character is in some ways similar to my dad's, because my father was a professional boxer. And he was a Jewish kid growing up on the streets. He was a street kid during the Depression. And his parents owned a candy store. And just like, you know, Garfield's parents in the movie did. And he was very much into boxing. He wanted to be a boxer. He became an amateur boxer. And against his mother's wishes, against his father's wishes, he was a boxer. And eventually turned pro. And he had to hide the fact that he turned pro. He was 17 years old. And he had to hide the fact that he was a pro boxer at the time. So
how does one do that?
They didn't have to know anything. They didn't have to know that he was boxing. He would go off. My father would go off and do whatever he wanted. You know, got in a lot of trouble as a kid too.
But I mean, didn't he ever get hit in the face sometimes? I mean,
oh yeah. You know, and it's like, you know, he got into fights. He got into scrapes, and it was just one of those things where he hid it as much as he could from his parents. So, anyways, that made me think again of my dad when I was watching that, and so Garfield was like the guy. And the other thing is that when John Garfield, right before the breaking point, he went back to the theater. You know, he started in the group theater. He was actually in Golden Boy. He was originally in Golden Boy, and Clifford Odets had written the play for Garfield, and you know, the movie ended up starring William Holden. I think it was a big disappointment to Garfield that he didn't star in the movie. And I think he should have, you know, nothing against William Holden, but that role should have been John Garfield. But he went back, unlike a lot of big stars, he actually went back to the theater and he did a play called Skipper Next to God during the late 40s, which was a play about a boat full of Jewish immigrants who were trying to leave Nazi Germany and were turned away. And he's the boat captain. And they're being turned away. They were turned away in different places in Europe, South America. They're turned away in the United States. But anyways, Garfield had that courage to go back to the theater. A lot of actors didn't do that, wouldn't do that. So my parents actually saw that on Broadway. It was on Broadway, and they actually saw John Garfield in Skipper Next to God on Broadway.
Wow.
And then after he was blacklisted and he couldn't get any work, he went to, and he did a pretty successful run of in Golden Boy. He got to play the lead in Golden Boy on Broadway. And my parents went and saw that, actually got to see that also.
Jeez. Wow. That's amazing.
So, you know, it was a popular play, you know, and that was a time that, you know, my mom, of course, wanted to go see John Garfield. You know, in addition, they saw Brando and Jessica Dandy in Streetcar on Broadway.
Oh my Lord. Wow.
So anyways, that's the thing about John Garfield, why he was kind of special kind of growing up, because he was my mom's favorite.
You kind of owe your whole existence to the fact that John Garfield exists.
That's right. Now, she married my dad. You know, she wanted to be with my dad because he looked like John Garfield.
Right. I mean, if your dad had looked like George Raft, your mom might have passed him by. I mean, so.
Thank goodness he didn't look like George Raft.
Well, so one of the things I've said this on previous episodes of Fade Out is that one of the things that I like about this show, about my own show, if I may say that, is that it forces me to, and I mean that in the best possible way, forces me to go see movies that I would not normally see, because of course, again, we all have, you know, we all have 1,000 streaming services, and there's times where there's so much to watch, I can't decide. And I mentioned this, I think, in the episode I did just last month with Jill Blake. We were talking about William Wyler, where, you know, sometimes you default to something easy because you can't decide what you want to watch. So you just put on, you know, Jaws for the 95th time. But in this case, you know, it's like, okay, I'm going to go check out some John Garfield movies. And I had, for some reason, not that I really had thought about it, but I thought, well, okay, I've seen at least like 5 or 6 John Garfield movies. I've never seen this last one. He ran all the way. So I got to check that one out. But I'll bone up on a couple more of his movies just to have a better sense of who he was. I went to his IMDb profile. I had seen only two of his movies. That's it. That's all I'd ever seen. Gentleman's Agreement, which he's a co-star in. It's not even...
He's a cameo in that
yeah.
movie.
And Force of Evil. And I'd only seen Force of Evil last year because I've been going through the list of all the movies mentioned in Martin Scorsese's A Personal Journey Through American Movies documentary. And I'm going through every movie he mentions to finally catch up on that. And that was finally on Blu-ray last year. So up until last year, I'd only seen one John Garfield movie. I couldn't believe it. So I was like, okay, well, now I'm really going to catch up. And I watched Body and Soul. I'd never seen that before. I saw The Postman Always Rings twice. I couldn't believe I had never seen that. But I hadn't. I'd seen the remake, but I hadn't seen the original. And then I checked out Nobody Lives Forever, which I enjoyed a lot. Breaking Point, which I enjoyed a lot. And Four Daughters. And then, of course, He Ran All the Way. And I'm curious as to what you think his appeal was, or if you agree with me, is that I watched his movies, and especially all his film noir ones. And unlike a lot of the other kind of movie tough guys, like a Bogart or George Raft, like we just mentioned, or even like Paul Muni or something like that, I feel like those guys feel like their persona was more like they were like bulls in china shops. And Garfield, I feel like there's something about his face where he's kind of got a tough guy face, but he also looks sort of sensitive, that I feel like in a lot of his movies, he plays one of these guys who's a tough guy, but yet he is just completely buffeted by the fate around him. And he kind of gets tossed around by external forces. And you immediately have sympathy for him because he seems, again, like I mentioned in the intro, maybe not always playing the brightest guy in the world, but not a bad guy. In some respects, He Ran All the Way, we'll talk about that. He's not a good guy in that movie. But for the most part, he's not a bad guy, but he can't catch a break, which seems to be like the epitome of film noir, someone just sort of trapped in their circumstances. Why do you like John Garfield? What do you think his persona was that people latched onto so heavily?
I think he's a film noir icon, similar to Robert Mitchum. And I think it was the raw power that Garfield exuded, but also there'd never been an actor like him before. He influenced Brando, De Niro, Pacino, Dean. None of those guys would have come along without John Garfield. He was the first of his kind. The idea, the method, you were talking about emotion, you know, to find that character and to relate to that character. You know, he wasn't a Humphrey Bogart. He wasn't a Spencer Tracy, who were both great actors in their own way. But Garfield was very different. And he relates more to what he was prescient in the sense that what was to come as far as movie acting, you know, Brando, Montgomery Clift, James Dean. He was the first of his kind with that. And honestly, I don't think Warner Brothers, who he had his contract with for so long, did him a lot of favors because he was aware of it. You know, they kind of like typecast him as that tough guy, you know, that, you know, smart talking tough guy. And he really wanted to break away from that. And speaking of breaking, the breaking point, in my opinion, is his greatest role. It's his best performance.
I love movie.
You know, he is amazing in that movie. It might be his best movie, although, you know, Force of Evil and Body and Soul come close. He's fantastic, and He Ran All the Way also. But, you know, the breaking point, because I think a lot of Garfield and his life is there on the screen in the breaking point. The relationship with his wife, because, you know, he had a lot of affairs. But he loved his wife, and he tried to keep his marriage going, and he had two small children. And a lot of what you see in that back and forth between Phyllis Thaxter, who plays his wife, and John Garfield was John Garfield and his wife, Robbie. You know, she was the one who was associated with the Communist Party, the American Communist Party. It was not Garfield. He had friends, and his politics leaned heavily left, but he was not a political. He was not necessarily political. They were kind of coming after her and the fact that he was married to her, and he was protecting her. He protected her. And of course he wasn't going to name names. So But anyways, I think it's the raw power, the method. He was the first to be kind of like a method actor. And that's what made him so much different from anybody else at that time.
You definitely can draw a through line between him and then, as you said, like Brando and Cliff, the guys that would come just after he died, just after. I mean, Brando came really started coming, you know, coming to the fore in the mid-50s.
And Cliff, his first film was 1948. Mm-hmm. He was in The Search and Red River, and Brando had done The Men, and I believe The Men was 50. So they're around the same time, but there's no doubt that they were influenced by him. And I think there's relation between Brando and like Stella Adler, who was his acting teacher. Mm-hmm. And she worked and she was part of the group theater. And, you know, her husband, Harold Clurman, was part of the group theater. So I'm sure she showed Brando and talked to Brando about Garfield. And so, you know, there's a lot of relationship there. I don't think there's any doubt that they were influenced, that Brando was influenced by Garfield. And then after that, you had Dean, who was influenced by Brando. And I think Clift was also influenced by Garfield.
You mentioned the group theater, and I read there's a couple of biographies about John Garfield, one called Body and Soul, but there's another one called He Ran All the Way. And I read that one in anticipation of this recording. And there's this, he talks about his life in the group theater and how they were all very, you know, we're art for art's sake and we were actors. And then he got tapped to go to Hollywood. And everyone in the group theater kind of looked at him a little bit like, what a sellout, you know, like, oh, you're going to go to Hollywood and make, and he was like, yeah, I'm going to Hollywood. And then they said something like within 2 years after that, like 90% of the group theater went to Hollywood. Like, you know, so it was like they all were giving him shit about it, but it was like, well, just because they really wanted to do it.
Yeah, too. Clifford Odets, you know, ended up going, and he was writing screenplays for, you know, for Hollywood movies. So, yeah, you know, it's like funny. It's the same thing happened to Brando, who was, you know, on the stage, you know, and he did, you know, he got noticed in Truckline Cafe and they ended up doing Streetcar, and he's like the rage of Hollywood and the theater. And then he runs off and he does movies and it's like, oh, you sell out, you know? And unlike Brando, John Garfield went back to the theater, you know, and he ended up doing, even while he was still at Warner's and he was still popular, he did the play Skipper Next to God. And then after his blacklisting, he ended up doing, he got to do Golden Boy, which he never was able to be in the movie, even though the play was written for him, and he got to be in it on Broadway, you know, after he was blacklisted, because that's the only thing he could do, because he couldn't do anything else. He couldn't get a job in television. They weren't going to get him, let him work in there, so he only could go back to the theater, which was his first love.
Yeah, and you know, you talk about his politics, and that, yeah, he was, again, from the, when I read in the book, that he was certainly, as you know, we think of it, very lefty in terms of his beliefs about the way you should treat people and the common man and stuff like that. But he was certainly not a communist by any stretch of the imagination, like, you know, a series of rigid doctrine that he was following. He was just kind of like, yeah, I think the workers should make more money. Why wouldn't that? You know, he was that kind of guy.
He was very much for civil rights. He mm-hmm. fought for Canada Lee being in Body and Soul.
Right.
And he also, Juan O. Hernandez to be in Breaking Point. You know, so yeah, he definitely was a liberal's liberal. You might say, and he may have attended a communist meeting with his wife at some point, you know, just for the hell of it. Who knows? I don't know, but he certainly was not a communist. Mm-hmm. And they came after, they were probably coming after his wife, and they were coming after him because he was married to her.
Yeah. Yeah.
The thing is that I've always looked at John Garfield as a hero because he stood up against the against UAC, and he would not name names, and he kind of told them off too. You know, I mean, to his detriment, it was career suicide, but he didn't care. And when you think about the people who did end up naming names, Sterling Hayden,
Lee J. Cobb eventually did.
And Ilie Kazan. You know, and he was the biggest of them all. He was a really big star. I know I said that before, but I can't emphasize enough what a big star he was. And for him to do what he did was an incredible sacrifice.
Why do you think, if you can, I mean, again, I don't know how much of an expert you are about this particular period, but I'm sort of curious, like, why was it that somebody like John Garfield could get ruined by that, when someone like Humphrey Bogart, now obviously Bogart was a bigger name, because Bogart, like the biggest of the big, but you know, Bogart and Bacall told HUAC to go pound sand. And they
kind of did. I don't know. They didn't do it to the extent that Garfield did. Mm. I know that they had gone to Washington, D.C., and they were in a rally in Washington, D.C., but I don't remember Garfield. I don't remember Bogart ever being called in front of HUAC and actually talking to HUAC and being – having to name names. You know, Edward G. Robinson named names.
Yeah.
And you know, the guys who didn't, they suffered. And I think that I think they came after him, you know, because of his wife, because of Robbie. I think, you know, she was involved with politics. And I think that the fact that he was always very active, he was active in civil rights, and I think that it was known that he was left wing, you know, even in his statement, you know, to HUAC, he said, you know, I'm no communist. I'm not pink. You know, he said, you know, but he was very liberal. He was very liberal. And he said that, he stated that my politics are liberal. I am a liberal. You know, he didn't deny who he was. But he had an amazing amount of courage. You know, going back to Gentleman's Agreement, being Jewish myself, I hate that movie. I really can't stand that movie. But the only thing I love about that movie, and the only reason I'll watch it, is for John Garfield's brief moment in it. Mm. He's so good. He's so real, and he's so true. There's nothing phony about that. That movie comes across to me, and I won an Academy Award for Best Film, and it's directed by Ilie Kazan, who's Jewish. It's a phony film to me, and I can't stand it. But he is so good, and I can't recommend enough people to just, if you can just watch him in that movie and his brief scene in that movie, it's just so damn good. I mean, that's what it was about to be Jewish, not all the other crap that's going on. You know, what John Garfield's going through in that movie. And that's the other thing about John Garfield. Never tried to hide that he was Jewish. Never. And I think, you know, I heard, you know, to a slight degree, I know his daughter, Julie, and she said that she felt that the witch hunt, the Red Scare during that time, particularly in Hollywood, was more anti-Semitic than anything else. Hmm. That most of the people who were blacklisted were Jewish. And she's right. Hmm. And I think that's another reason that they went after Garfield, was not only that he was a liberal, but he was a Jew.
Hmm. Now, before we get off this, because I do want to ask you about other stuff related to his other movies, but what specifically about Gentleman's Agreement? I have not seen it in a very long time. What is it about the movie that you find so phony?
Because it's not really, it's about anti-Semitism or prejudice against Jews through a Gentile's eyes.
Gregory Peck
is Gentile, and he's posing as a Jew, you know, and what happens to him. You know, it's a sanitized look at anti-Semitism, except for Garfield's scene, which is pure and raw and real.
I haven't seen Gentleman's Agreement in a long time, but when I watched Four Daughters, which, as we said, it's his first film, The book that I read about him, I read the book before I had seen the movie, and it talks about how that he really is like a jolt of electricity in this movie. And I was like, oh, okay, I had that in the back of my head as I watched it. And as I mentioned, it's directed by Michael Curtiz and it stars Claude Rains. There's a lot of really great talented people in it, but I did find it to be pretty rough going. I just thought it was pretty dull and just not terribly interesting. And then John Garfield walks into it. And it really is that thing of like, you can't, to this day, I feel like you still can't quite put your finger on what makes someone a star. What is it about their screen personality that gives them such charisma? It's not that he's hogging the film. He's not hamming it up, but he is just so much more interesting than kind of anything else going on in that movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it goes back to, I think, the fact that, you know, he was the way he acted was much, much different than anybody else did. Mm-hmm. You got Claude Rains, who I love.
I love Claude Rains.
He's very different the way Claude Rains approaches a role and is in a role. John Garfield's like, man, it's real. There's a raw power that's going on there. And I haven't seen Four Daughters in many, many years. I saw it when I was a kid. I haven't seen it since. I remember not even liking it that much when I saw it as a kid. I don't know how well it's dated.
It's pretty dated.
doesn't sound like, yeah, it's dated very well. But I ended up doing, and I've seen a lot of his movies. I saw a lot of his those early movies that he did right afterwards, you know, Castle on the Hudson and, They Made Me a Criminal, mm-hmm. which are like vehicles made for him and his, that type that they were doing, that he was like a New York type, you know, New York tough guy. And those movies, although are interesting and they're interesting to watch, it's those later movies that he made when he was really trying to broaden himself, you know, Body and Soul, Force of Evil, Breaking Point, He Ran All the Way, and Postman also, which was on as we were about to record. It was on PCM, and I just had to sit and watch it, and I'm just, you know, marveling at the amazing chemistry between those two. He's fantastic in it. He's terrific in it.
He really is. The scene in Postman Always Rings Twice where he meets Lana Turner for the first time, you know, and of course she is dripping with sexuality as far as a movie could go in 1946. And then he meets, it's the other way around. He's looking for a job. He gets a job at this diner played by, and the diner owner is Cecil Calloway, this kind of old frumpy guy. Then, you know, Cecil Calloway goes out to talk to a customer or something because it's a gas station as well. And then he meets Lana Turner and he can't, you know, he doesn't know who this is, that she clearly has the run of the place, but it's, and then she mentions that Cecil Calloway is her husband.
actually Calloway says, did you meet, I said, you know, I'll go tell, when he's burning the sign, he's burning the Help Wanted sign.
Calloway says
to him, oh, you're great, you're taking the job, I'll go tell my wife.
Your wife.
But going back to the moment that they meet, what a scene. She comes out in that white, that sexy white outfit, and she drops her lipstick and it rolls over to him. You know, he's about, I don't know, 10 feet away, and it rolls over to him and he picks it up and she expects him to like bring it to her. And he just holds it. And this was what John Garfield was. This is why he was so great as an actor. You know, he just kind of like does this thing where he leans, he's holding the lipstick and he just leans against the counter in the diner, you know, and he just gives her this look. It's just great. And the chemistry between them, like I said, the chemistry between them is so fantastic. It's what makes that movie. I love that film. I've read James Cain's book, to be honest with you, and I know this is kind of sacrilegious. I actually like the movie better than I like the book. Mm-hmm.
When you're right, you're recalling the scene correctly. When he sees on his face, when he realizes again, when Calloway tells him that that's his wife, you can almost see something go over Garfield's face. Like he knows, like, oh shit, this is going to be trouble now, because, mm-hmm. because you're just like, Cecil Calloway and Lana Turner don't even look like the same species. You know, you're like, what is she doing married to this old frumpy guy? And it's almost like, you know, Garfield's like, it's just like, oh, now I know I'm going to have to go after her because look who she's married to. Come on.
Well, there's that moment. You see it. He doesn't even have to say anything. He just,
no.
He says your wife, but there's that moment where you can see he's like, he wants to go. He wants to get back on the road. He wants to leave. But he realizes, like, wait, no, I can't. I want to stay because of her. And that's another thing that made him such a good actor, is that he didn't even have to say anything. He was able to, you know, through his eyes, through his emotions, through his gestures. I mean, he was just a terrific actor. I mean, he really did kind of change film, movie acting. I mean, I think of Marlon Brando as the person who changed movie acting. But I think that I think Garfield has kind of kicked it off, and Brando took the torch and kind of ran with it.
Right. He also has great hair. Garfield had great tousled hair. Like his hair could kind of help play, where sometimes it was disheveled and it looked kind of gave you a certain persona, and then other times it was more matted down. So before we get on to He Ran All the Way, I do want to ask you, as a boxing beyond, I don't even know what it's, oops, super fan, it's in your blood, literally, body and soul. Like, what, where do you rank that among, like, some, like, the great, is it one of, in your eyes, like one of the great boxing films? And,
oh, yeah.
And as a boxing expert, what makes it a great boxing movie?
It's in my top five. Okay. My five favorites are The Setup, Raging Bull, then I'd put Fat City, Body and Soul, and Requiem for a Heavyweight. So it's in my top five.
All right.
Favorite boxing movies. I think it's a great story. Of course, it was done by Garfield's Enterprise Studios, which was, yep, he produced it. You know, and he created his own production company. And Abraham Polonsky blacklisted.
Yep.
So many people in Body and Soul were blacklisted, were associated, yep, with that. I think it's a great story. It was actually it was originally going to be based on Barney Ross, the Jewish lightweight champion, who his life, but they ended up changing the story some. But I think the boxing scenes are fantastic, and James Wong Howe, who's a cinematographer, did a great job.
He did a lot of movies with John Garfield.
Yes, he did. He did. He did. He Ran All the Way.
He ran all the way. Yeah.
I don't know what other movie he did.
I saw his name a couple of times as I was going through his filmography. Like, oh, there he is again with working with John Garfield.
But it's the typical story, of course, for boxing, for these boxing movies, was fighter is up and coming. He comes from the streets, and you know, he forgets everybody else. He starts to make money, and you know, gets kind of caught with gangsters and, you know, the fixed fights and so forth. And yeah, it follows some of those cliches, but it probably started some of those cliches. You know, it was like kind of the first of its kind to show that. I do love the way Garfield comes back. The original ending was he was going to be shot and killed after not throwing the fight. I hope I'm not spoiling anything for anybody. You know, that last line where he says, what are you going to do, kill me? Everybody's going to die. You know, it's a great line. It's delivered fantastically by Garfield. He was a convincing boxer because he did box, you know, as an amateur. He did box some. So you can kind of tell in the ring that he can handle himself. I loved also the relationship between Canada Lee's character and John Garfield in that movie. I don't think you get to see that. It's in a lot of the boxing movies at that time, that relationship between two boxers, especially Garfield's being the one who beat Canada Lee and took his title. And then Canada Lee is working for him as his trainer. And there's a bond there. And just knowing also the backstory about their relationship and that they were friends and that John Garfield, you know, fought to have Canada Lee in the movie. And, you know, the other performance, Anne Revere is his mother. She's excellent. And she's also blacklisted.
My goodness. Well, they said that segues perfectly into He Ran All the Way because like half this movie was people that were blacklisted. Unfortunately, this movie came out on June 20th, 1951. I'm going to get into a brief plot synopsis here. John Garfield, of course, plays Nick Robey, a small-time crook. Along with his partner, Al, they attempt a payroll heist. During the robbery, they kill a police officer and Al is wounded. Nick, along with the money, leaves Al behind and tries to hide in plain sight at a public pool. It's there he meets Peg, a young single woman. They make a date for that night, and Nick picks up Peg at her family's apartment. When Nick hears the news that there is a manhunt for him, he takes Peg's family, her mother and father and little brother, hostage. As Nick's paranoia increases, Peg's family begs him to leave, saying they won't give him up. Nick allows Peg's father to go to work the next day, threatening him with consequences if he reveals what's going on. He gives Peg some cash to buy a new car, thinking she will run away with him. Peg returns, but without the car, saying it will be delivered later that night. Nick, furious that she is lying, grabs Peg and tries to leave, but Mr. Dobbs is waiting outside. He shoots Nick, causing Nick to drop his gun. Wounded, he asks Peg to hand the gun back to him. Instead, Peg shoots Nick. He collapses in the street just as the new car is delivered. So, okay, had you seen this movie before we decided to talk about John Garfield?
Yeah, I'd seen it a couple of times.
Oh, a couple of times, okay. Mm-hmm. I'd never seen it before, as I mentioned earlier, and it's terrific. Yeah. I mean, it's a really great, I mean, and I have to say, just not directly related, but tangential, we seem to be in an era now of modern movies where every movie is 2 hours and like 40 minutes, and when I pulled open He Ran All the Way, and it's like 79 minutes. I was like, all right, yeah, like this thing's going to tell its story, get in and get out. And, you know, it's a full meal. This movie's a full meal. It tells its story. It does not need to be any longer than so. I feel like that's a lost art, being able to tell a story.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt.
Story in 79 minutes.
Are quite long and getting longer.
Yeah, yeah.
As we speak. I mean, the days of like The Godfather and Godfather 2 being – you know, like so long and people talking about it. It's like most movies now are close to 3 hours.
Yeah.
But He Ran All the Way. Yeah, he's terrific in it. And he was under investigation at that time by HUAC. And I think it comes through a lot in his performance, this paranoia.
Yeah.
That he is so... It comes about so well, the paranoia and the shifting of his personality and how he can be very kind at one point and then angry at one point and then very paranoid. It's hard to feel sympathy for his character. He plays it so well. The cinematography by James Wong Howe is fantastic.
It's a beautiful movie.
Way he photographed that movie, the film, and he lit it is just great. And considering that most of the movie takes place in an apartment, says something too.
I'm curious about that. James Wong Howe, is that, again, I'll get into the crew, the creative people behind this movie in a second. But as I mentioned, a lot of them were people that were blacklisted. Were about to be blacklisted, or at the very least, as you talked about, like under questioning, under suspicion. Could someone like James Wong Howe just flit in between projects and work with people like this, and he didn't suffer any consequence? Not that he should have, obviously, but I was kind of curious as to how James Wong Howe had a long career. I mean, long, long career, and yet it's like, did the government not?
I don't think it was guilt by association in that way. I think if you'd worked with somebody like that, who had been under investigation or was suspected, it would affect you, unless you were brought in front of HUAC and you refused to cooperate. But, you know, I mean, Dalton Trumbo wrote the screenplay to this movie, and he had been blacklisted, and it was him, Guy Endor was the front. It says Guy Endor is wrote the screenplay. So, you know, and I mean, for that matter, you could think Michael Curtiz. It's like, why wasn't Michael Curtiz? Because Garfield specifically wanted Michael Curtiz to direct The Breaking Point, because he had worked so much with Curtiz, as he said, with Four Daughters, and then eventually with Seawolf, and with other films. And Garfield gave a lot of credit to Michael Curtiz for, like, you know, helping his career. But he worked closely with Curtiz too. You know, I mean, the Breaking Point, he shaped a lot of that movie. He was almost like a ghost producer of that film. He had made a lot of the decisions that went on in that film as far as the characters and casting and such. But I don't know. It was a strange time. It was a tragic, terrible, horrible time. A lot of it made no sense.
This movie was directed by John Barry, who passed away in 1999. He actually kept directing well into the 90s. And he did his last film is a film with Danny Glover called Bozeman and Lena, which I have not seen. Another movie called Cross My Heart. Another film called Claudine. He also did The Bad News Bears Go to Japan, which seems like a just sort of Claudine random.
The ones you mentioned, I've seen Claudine. That's a good movie.
Oh, Claudine is good? Okay. Good. Bad News Bears Goes to Japan just feels like a very strange credit to have in this group. But he had a longer... But John Barry was blacklisted as well. And I was reading up on this movie, and it said that there were some prints of this film that list someone else as director because he was blacklisted. So at one point, you had both the director and the screenwriters using... replaced by pseudonyms because they were all blacklisted, starring a guy who was blacklisted. I mean, this movie is a sort of ground zero for...
So was Body and Soul. Actually, so was Body and Soul, because, Kennedy Lee was blacklisted, Garfield was blacklisted, Ann Revere was blacklisted, the guy who plays Shorty was blacklisted, Abraham Polonsky, who wrote the screenplay, was blacklisted, Robert Rawson, the great director who directed the film, was actually brought up in front of HUAC, and he named names. So he could have been blacklisted if he hadn't named names. So both of those movies, both He Ran All the Way and Body and Soul, as you said, were kind of ground zero for just, you know, the witch hunt and the Red Scare.
You have to wonder if at some point Garfield just didn't sort of shrug his shoulders and say, well, I'm going to make these movies because I want to make these movies. You know, it's almost like the cake is baked. So why don't we just make the movies? Because, I mean, obviously, if he wanted to, he could have said, I'm going to stay far away from these people and try and pull, you know, reduce some of the heat on me. But think about it. A bunch of his last films are all with blacklisted guys. You mentioned Abraham Polonsky, who was involved in Force of Evil. I mean, he really almost kind of leaned into the skid a little bit. And again, a lot of these films are just absolutely terrific. Force of Evil is terrific. I do want to mention the cast a little bit of this film. Obviously, John Garfield is the star. It also features Shelley Winters, the great Shelley Winters, as Peg. She passed away in 2006. She was in movies like Night of the Hunter, Lolita, Patch of Blue, The Poseidon Adventure. Wallace Ford plays Mr. Dobbs. He passed away in 1966. He was also in Patch of Blue with Shelley Winters.
He was in The Breaking Point.
He's in Breaking Point. He was in Harvey, Shadow of a Doubt.
He has a great role in The Setup. Also.
He's in The Setup. He was in Freaks. He was in Todd Browning's Freaks. Serena Royal plays Mrs. Dobbs. She passed away in 1983. She was in The Heiress, Date with Judy, and Robot Monster. There's a credit. Gladys George plays Mrs. Roby. She passed away in 1954. She was in films like The Roaring Twenties, The Maltese Falcon, The Best Years of Our Lives, and Detective Story. The great Norman Lloyd plays Al. He passed away just last year at like the age of like 103 or something. He was in Spellbound, Dead Poets Society, Saboteur. He was in the Amy Schumer movie Trainwreck. I think that's his last credit. And Bobby Hyatt plays Peg's little brother. He plays Tommy. He passed away in 2007. He was in movies like It's a Big Country, Bachelor Father, and Combat. Shelley Winters, boy, she is – Shelley Winters, for someone my age who kind of grew up with her as the more kind of – you know, kind of blousy broad lady from Poseidon Adventure. It's and you go back and you watch her in these younger movies, boy, she's terrific. She is great in this movie. And she is totally plausible as a dame fitting for John Garfield's character.
Yeah. I don't think she gets enough credit for some
of these, Oscars for Pete's sake.
You know, yeah. For these early roles that she did, I think she, when people think of her, it's exactly like you said, they think of her around the time of Lolita, Poseidon Adventure, which she won the Oscar for, I know. But she was also in A Place in the Sun, and I think that's like one of her best performances. It was, she played a very unglamorous role, and she's very good in it. It's pretty tough to play second fiddle to Elizabeth Taylor and
Montgomery Clift.
Yeah.
She has a line in this movie that made me laugh where it's, when her parents are getting a sense that this guy that she's brought home is no good. And at first they're thinking, well, once he reveals himself to be this crook, she's going to dump him, but she can't quite do it. She can't quite, she likes him. And even against her own best interest, she's still kind of attracted to him. And there was, she has some line about kind of like, I don't know what's wrong with me, which made me think that like in the life of this character before we got to her, and He Ran All the Way, it was like she has this history of just dating, you know, movie tough guys. It's like she's got a type. It's like, first I dated George Raft, then Laird Krieger, now this, you know. It's like she can't, you want to like Mr. and Mrs. Dobson, like, what is wrong with you? Why can't you just meet a nice guy, for Pete's sake? Because it's like he's so, I mean, good, he pulls a gun on his on her parents, and yet she still is not totally ready to kick him to the curb.
Yeah. You know, Julie Garfield was talking about the movie, He Ran All the Way, and she said that Shelley Winters was a pain in the butt on the set because, you know, she wanted her scenes rewritten, and specifically she wanted the movie to end with her running to, like, seeing him die on the street and like running to him, and that the movie should end with a close up on her. And
wow.
They didn't have anything of it. It's a great ending. His death scene is pretty damn good.
Yeah.
On the streets. That's a really great death scene. And it's beautifully composed. That shot, on the street, so beautifully composed by Jing Wong Hao. It's beautiful. There's some amazing compositions by Hao in this movie. Some of the close-ups, some of the stuff in the stairwell, the shadows in the stairwell. He was so talented. I mean, I think his work shows off even more in this than it did in Body and Soul. And a lot of times in Body and Soul, people talk about, well, you know, he filmed the boxing scenes on roller skates. You know, it was like the very, very famous thing that he, you know, oh, he did that, this innovative thing. And the boxing scenes are great. But I think his work in He Ran All the Way is even better.
There are some shots in this that to me look like they couldn't be, because this was before that, but they look like almost like those like split diopter shots where you've got something very extreme in the foreground. I mean, of course, you know, Greg Toland was doing this in Citizen Kane, which we talked about over on Citizen Kane Minute, but there's shots where there is something extreme in the foreground, way in the background, and everything is sort of in focus at the same time. And it really is, again, it's very, very powerful. And as you mentioned, like, you know, once he goes back to Peg's apartment, the rest of the movie takes place in just basically this one room, or these couple of rooms. There's the brief scene in the bakery that the father works at and stuff. But for the most part, it all just takes place in this one setting. Again, which is, you know, that's sort of separating the men from the boys kind of thing. By the way, I had to mention, I love that the public pool that they meet at is called The Plunge, which is the most fabulous thing. That's like, right, a nightclub. Like, you can name that any other kind of, like, just, I was just like, The Plunge. That's masterful. It's just, what a great name for a business, no matter what it is. The opening sequence where him and Al, you know, pull off the heist, it's pretty, I mean, it's not graphic. I mean, it's a 1952 movie, but it's pretty prettied up. for lack of a better term, like the
it's pretty gritty stuff, I think. I think Eddie Muller mentioned this, that Garfield's career, his ascension to these other roles, fits along that timeline for classic film noir. And you could almost say that He Ran All the Way might be the end of classic film noir. And it had ramped up to that point where, you know, you got that kind of, that gritty, harsh hold up. You know, there's nothing romanticized about that scene.
The dad, Mr. Dobbs, as I mentioned, played by Wallace Ford, again, he's, you know, he's considerably older than Nick Roby in this film. And, you know, he goes on and on about it. You know, he's not going to do anything to risk his family's life. He's got a young son and his wife and stuff. And yet he's like, this film reminded me a bit of The Desperate Hours, which is a movie I love with Humphrey Bogart and Frederick March, one of my all time favorite actors, Frederick March. But that's a similar home invasion movie where a crook takes over and sort of, you know, keeps these people hostage. In that film, there's a lot about Frederick March's sort of the henpecked kind of commentary on suburban husbands. Are they kind of weakened now and they can't, you know, defend their family in an emergency? Here, I mean, the Mr. Dobbs is, you know, he kind of bides his time and he never really risks. He doesn't want to risk anything. Obviously, he doesn't want his family to get shot. But when sort of push comes to shove, he really steps up, and it's really pretty remarkable where he is a really brave guy, and he takes some serious risks. And as I mentioned in the plot synopsis, he's the one that finally puts the bullet in Nick, which allows Peg to finish him off. But it's like I'm not that familiar with this actor, Wallace Ford. You mentioned he was in the Setup, and I said he was in Patch of Blue.
Great. He's one of the great character actors. He's really good in The Breaking Point also.
Yeah.
He and John Garfield have some great moments in that film, and they played off each other well. And, you know, I wonder with He Ran All the Way being produced by Garfield, if he had something to do with Wallace Ford being cast. But yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, even in that, there's a scene where Wallace Ford and John Garfield are sitting together. Wallace Ford is working on a model of a ship. And I think it's that scene. Well, no, actually, it's the scene where John Garfield has brought in a meal for the family. He has bought this an elaborate meal with a big roast turkey. And he wants the family to eat the roast turkey he bought. And they refuse, and they're eating a home-cooked stew. And he's pushing them. Garfield is pushing them to eat. In fact, he pulls a gun on them. That they need to eat the meal that he bought them.
You're going to eat my dinner.
But Wallace Ford says at that point, he says, you know, you're going to push me. And you're going to, you know, there's a line that will be drawn that even if you shoot me, I don't care.
Yep.
You know, so he gives that foreshadowing. That character gives that foreshadowing that, you know, you're going to push me too far to the point where, you know, I don't care what happens to me. I'm going to take you down.
And he tells Nick Roby that you're going to end up a dead man one way or the other, you know, right. Sort of like, I might not be the guy that does it, but you're going to end up a dead man. And it's the look that comes across Nick's face, Garfield's face, is almost like he kind of knows that, you know, does he really think? He tells himself that Peg is going to run off with him, but he's got to know on some level that's not going to happen. She's not going to actively choose this to go off with this guy. She seems maybe a little tempted or something like that, maybe because, again, she's got kind of a screw loose. But, I mean, again, he has this sort of fatalistic kind of view of like, well, I've put myself in this situation. But funny, but he actually, like in a lot of film noir, he initially when he thinks they're on to him when they're not, and he ends up revealing it, and then the news story comes on that they're looking out for him. So he kind of gives himself up
It goes back to that paranoia that that Garfield lent to the role. You know, he's really paranoid throughout the film. He's paranoid from the moment the movie opens, when he's having this horrific nightmare that his mother wakes him up from.
What a great scene with him and his mother.
Yeah.
You see why he turned out the way he did.
So, I thought about Desperate Hours also, the first time I ever saw the movie. And I can't help but think about Desperate Hours. I haven't seen that in a long time, but from what I remember, it's very interesting to think about, how Bogart played that role of the home invader and how Garfield played it. Very, very different. I mean, you feel like, I love Humphrey Bogart, but you feel like, you're watching it and it's like you can't help but feel it's Humphrey Bogart, even though you're immersed in the film and you love the film. With John Garfield, you get the feeling he's Nick. He is Nick. And that is that naturalistic kind of like raw emotion that he brought to his acting that was so different. He wasn't a star up there, you know, performing. Not to take anything away from any of other stars and the way they approach their roles, but it was very different with him. And it had this kind of grittiness that the shame of it is that he died when he was 39 and he was really looking to broaden his horizons as an actor and do more things. And who knows what he could have ended up doing.
You got to wonder if had he not, of course, you know, gotten caught up in all that Huex stuff, if what he would have moved on to. I'm like, you know, when I look at He Ran All the Way, and, you know, things we talk about now that, like, we in, you know, 2022 look at people from earlier eras when they are our age now. We're like, God, is that what people looked like when we were older? You know what I mean? Like John Garfield in this movie is 39. He looked, to me, looks way older than 39. You know, I'm like, did I look like that when I was 39? Like, you know, I'm a full 10 years older than John Garfield is in this movie. But people just kind of looked older then. It just kind of had that look to them. But it would have been interesting to see what if he could have got. I mean, you mentioned The Breaking Point, which is, again, a terrific movie. But I don't think it was a particular, you know, hit in any way.
Like, it was not. It was a flop, was He Ran All the Way.
Yeah.
Was also a flop, as was Ports of Evil. They were all flops. And these were movies that Garfield had a strong role in producing and wanting to do, and selecting people like Abraham Polonsky and Robert Rossen and Dalton Trumbo to go ahead and collaborate with. So he was definitely looking to do that, you know, as you look, when you look at his filmography and you see where he was going, you know, and he created his own production company also, you know,
right,
because he wanted more control. I think who knows what he could have done. I think he would have ended up doing some great stuff, some great things, some great movies, you know, it was for the art. And I think that, I don't think he was caught up in fame and stardom. I think it was about doing the roles. I mean, I don't think that he eschewed stardom, but, you know, I think that he wanted to be a great actor and he tried to broaden. He was trying to broaden his horizon. And he was so good in The Breaking Point. Force of Evil is a fantastic movie. And He Ran All the Way. He's excellent in it.
Yeah. One of the things I took note of in the biography about him that I thought was really kind of charming, but then also tragic in some ways is, and I thought of this because you mentioned his producing partner. He did this company, Bob Roberts was his producing partner. And they talked about that, you know, for a guy who was very successful for a good 10 years, presumably making a lot of money, he didn't have a lot of money to fall back on when the work started thinning out. And that was part of the problem was that, you know, and the people have said, well, what did, you know, he was producing these movies with Bob Roberts and people have sort of said, well, what was Bob Roberts doing with all this money that they were making? Why didn't Garfield have more of it? But one of the things they mentioned in the book, which again, I thought was so charming, was they said that Garfield was incredibly generous to random people. And they told a specific story where he was backstage. He went back to New York at one point and I think he went to visit the group theater again or something. And somebody went up to him and said, "Hey, John, you remember me from the old days?" And Garfield was like, "Yeah, how you doing, Phil," or whatever it was. And the guy was basically putting the pinch on him and said, "Look, I'm really down on my luck. You know, maybe for the old time's sake, could I borrow, you know, a couple of $100? And Garfield just opens up his pocket and pulls off a bunch of money and hands it to this guy. And the guy walks away. And there's a friend of Garfield's is watching this. And he says, "That guy, do you know that guy?" And John Garfield says, "No, I never knew him." He says, "I knew we weren't friends because he called me John." He said, "Everybody called me Julie. Anyone that was, I was really friends with called me Julie." And the guy's like, "Well, then why'd you give him the money?" And Garfield says, "Well, he probably really needed it. So, you know, I gave it to him. I just pretended that I knew him." And I thought, wow, you know, like that's amazing. But apparently he did a lot of that kind of stuff. Like he was not, he didn't worry that much about money. And then I wonder, you know, when it came time when the work started thinning out, that didn't come back to bite him that generosity.
I think it doesn't surprise me. That story doesn't surprise me about him because that's the kind of person he was. Mm-hmm. You know, he, all the people that were under investigation from HUAC or somebody like Canada Lee, who, you know, was a black man and that, you know, the people who were going to distribute the film didn't want a black man in the role, you know, and he fought for it. Doesn't surprise me. I do know that, I mean, I don't know if they talked about this in the biography that you read, but, you know, Enterprise lost money. They went bankrupt. They produced a film, and I can't remember the name of the film, that Garfield was not in. It was a complete flop, and they lost tons of money. I think probably Garfield lost a lot of money through Enterprise Studios. But, you know, he ended up going, he ended up going and he was on the stage and he did Golden Boy. I mean, it was a success. He did have a heart problem, you know,
right.
But from, you know, his entire life. But of course, you know, it's HUAC that drove him, drove him to his death.
Yeah.
You know?
Most people do not die of heart attacks at 39 years old. Some do, but not, yeah, pretty rare. Again, especially since he was so handy. Again, there's a story where he talks about that in the book where he was up for, they were going to do an adaptation of Golden Boy. I think it was Golden Boy on television and he was up for it. And he was sure that he was going to get it. And then he was like at a party and somebody called him and said, "Oh, it's for you." And they said, the people that watched him watched his face just fall when they said, "No, you didn't get it. We're giving it to somebody else." And he just was crushed because it was like, well, who else was going to do it? You know, I'd be perfect. And I think they said there's not even any record of this production even existing. So I wonder if it ever even happened. But I mean, yeah, he couldn't even get that.
Because UAC and you know, what was the name of the newsletter that was put out?
Oh, God.
Red Channels.
Red Channels. That's right. Yep.
Red Channels had the names and that went to TV too. So it was not just, you know, movies, you know, it was television. The Blacklist went on in television. What's interesting is it didn't go on in the theater. You know, and he was able to do the theater, you know, I'm at least in New York, the New York theater. You know, I don't know about other places in the country, theaters in the other places in the country. But it emphasizes he knew what he was doing when he resisted HUAC and he refused to name names. And there were so many. Lloyd Bridges is another who named names. So many of these, you know, actors, directors, Edward Dimitrik was part of the Hollywood 10 and he ended up going back and naming names and then he got work. So he knew what he was doing. He could have gone back and said, you know, here are some names for you of people that I know are communists. And certainly he knew a bunch considering what we talked about with the breaking point and he ran all the way and Force of Evil and Body and Soul, but he still didn't, he still resisted. And that's why he's a hero in my mind. He'll always be a hero.
That's a really great place to wrap it up. Like I said, I think He Ran All the Way is a terrific movie. It was a career that was cut short But if you're going to have a glass film, I think that's not a bad one to go out on. I think it crystallized kind of a lot of his persona. And it's sort of, you know, again, a testament to how much you could do with probably not a lot of resources. You know, I mean, from a guy that was coming from Warner Brothers, where, you know, the sky was the limit in terms of the budgets and the sets and all the talent, but this was kind of done a little bit on a shoestring, and yet it still turned out terrific. And it's available on Amazon Prime, as are a lot of his movies. So I would recommend anyone who has not seen much in the way of John Garfield. And again, unfortunately, like, his legacy is a little harder to pin down because he didn't get to live on. I mean, it's sort of funny. I mean, he didn't have, like, you know, Bogart didn't live that much longer than John Garfield, but yet Bogart had a couple of bona fide, like Casablanca, you know, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. He had a couple of films that were so burned into the culture that his legacy will live on forever.
And I think he became an icon. He became like a pop culture icon, Bogart. And I don't think Garfield ever got a chance to do that. I mean, the most successful movie probably that he did was Postman Always Runs Twice.
Right.
And that was an MGM film. He was borrowed from Warner's to perform in that MGM film.
Yeah. There's, as I said, there's a lot of terrific movies out there, and I absolutely recommend
YouTube. Also, you can watch some of this stuff on YouTube. I don't always recommend it because it's not maybe always the best print, but He Ran All the Way is on YouTube.
Body and Soul is too.
Body and Soul, Force of Evil is also on YouTube. So, you know, if you don't have a certain streaming service like Amazon or some of the others, I think Amazon is the only place that you could maybe find some of his movies. A few of his movies, you can rent some of them too.
Yep.
But YouTube is a good place too.
Absolutely. So, well, Michael, I mean, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. We've had so much fun doing other shows together, recording, talking about different movies and stuff. And as I mentioned, talking about Superman vs. Muhammad Ali. And I love that I got to be more, knowledgeable about John Garfield, because like I said, I thought I'd seen a bunch of his movies. I was like, geez, I only seen two. And as you mentioned, Gentleman's Agreement barely counts because he's hardly even in it. So I'm glad that I got to see so many of these movies. They're really terrific. And especially He Ran All the Way. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Rob, to be able to talk about an actor that has meant a lot to me growing up, and who I still think is great. I still watch his movies and I still watch his performances, and I'm still like wowed by him. It's like, man, he was great.
He really was. Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at MW Cronenberg, I'm on Facebook some of the time. I work as a graphic designer for the Film Noir Foundation. I have a boxing magazine called Ringside Seat also. And I do a lot of work for Tomorrow's Publishing also.
What's your podcast? You should mention that.
Yes, my podcast. I have a podcast with my son. It's called The Cronenberg Chronicles. and we've had three episodes. We had a recent guest, writer Tom King, who's a very good friend, DC writer, we're gonna have a bunch more guests. Eddie Mueller's gonna be on, and
nice.
It's a fun thing that my son Nathan and I do, and we have a good time.
All right, excellent. Check it out, everybody. Of course, you can find back episodes of this show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to this show on any podcatcher of your choice. We're always talking movies on Twitter at FadeOutPod. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So if you really love Fade Out, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. So that's going to do it, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script, so it's time to fade out.
It's 11 o'clock, Mr. Roby. You can't lay there all day.
Beat it. Blow. Hey! Cut that out.
If you were a man, you'd be out looking for a job.
If you were a man, I'd kick your teeth in.
There's coffee on the stove. Don't ever talk to me like that, Nick.
You've been talked to worse.
Only by you, you dirty pup.
Oh, knock off, Mom. You've just got too big a hangover.
I'll kill you if you talk like that.
You're losing your punch, Mom.